Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, January 9th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our first article today, Trump lays out a vision of power restrained only by my own morality. On topic after topic, President Trump made clear that he would be the arbiter of any limits to his authorities, not international law or treaties. By David E. Sanger, Tyler Pager, Katie Rogers, and Zolan Cano Youngs. President Trump declared on Wednesday evening that his power as commander-in-chief is constrained only by his own morality, brushing aside international law and other checks on his ability to use military might to strike, invade, or coerce nations around the world. Asked in a wide-ranging interview with New York Times if there were any limits on his global power, Mr. Trump said, "Yeah, there is one thing, my own morality, my own mind. It's the only thing that can stop me. I don't need international law," he added. "I'm not looking to hurt people." When pressed further about whether his administration needed to abide by international law, Mr. Trump said, "I do." But he made clear he would be the arbiter when such constraints applied to the United States. "It depends what your definition of international law is," he said. Mr. Trump's assessment of his own freedom to use any instrument of military, economic, or political power to cement American supremacy was the most blunt acknowledgement yet of his worldview. At its core is the concept that national strength, rather than laws, treaties, and conventions, should be the deciding factor as powers collide. He did acknowledge some constraints at home, even as he has pursued a maximalist strategy of punishing institutions he dislikes, exacting retribution against political opponents, and deploying the National Guard to cities over the objections of state and local officials. He made clear that he uses his reputation for unpredictability and a willingness to resort quickly to military action, often in service of coercing other nations. During his interview with The Times, he took a lengthy call from President Gustavo Petro of Colombia, who was clearly concerned after repeated threats that Mr. Trump was thinking of an attack on the country similar to the one on Venezuela. "Well, we are in danger," Mr. Petro said in an interview with The Times just before the call, "because the threat is real. It was made by Trump." The call between the two leaders, the contents of which were off the record, was an example of coercive diplomacy in action, and it came just hours after Mr. Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio had extracted the United States from dozens of international organizations intended to foster multinational cooperation. In his conversation with The Times, Mr. Trump sounded more emboldened than ever. He cited the success of his strike on Iran's nuclear program. He keeps a model of the B-2 bombers used in the mission on his desk, the speed with which he decapitated the Venezuelan government last weekend, and his designs on Greenland, which is controlled by Denmark, a NATO ally. When asked what was his higher priority, obtaining Greenland or preserving NATO, Mr. Trump declined to answer directly, but acknowledged it may be a choice. He made clear that the transatlantic alliance was essentially useless without the United States at its core. Even as he characterized the norms of the post-World War II order as unnecessary burdens on a superpower, Mr. Trump was dismissive of the idea that the leader of China, Xi Jinping, or President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, could use similar logic to the detriment of the United States. On topic after topic, he made clear that in his mind, U.S. power is the determining factor, and that previous presidents have been too cautious to make use of it for political supremacy or national profit. The president's insistence that Greenland must become part of the United States was a prime example of his worldview. It was not enough to exercise the U.S. right under a 1951 treaty to reopen long-closed military bases on the huge landmass, which is a strategically important crossroads for U.S., European, Chinese, and Russian naval operations. "Ownership is very important," Mr. Trump said as he discussed with a real estate mogul's eye the landmass of Greenland, three times the size of Texas, but with a population of less than 60,000. He seemed to dismiss the value of having Greenland under the control of a close NATO ally. When asked why he needed to possess the territory, He said, because that's what I feel is psychologically needed for success. I think that ownership gives you a thing that you can't do, whether you're talking about a lease or a treaty. Ownership gives you things and elements that you can't get from just signing a document. The conversation made clear that in Mr. Trump's view, sovereignty and national borders are less important than the singular role the United States plays as the protector of the West. He argued that only he, and not two predecessors on whom he heaped scorn, Joseph R. Biden Jr. and Barack Obama, had proved capable of persuading NATO nations to spend 5% of the gross domestic product on defense. About 1.5% of that is actually for domestic infrastructure, from power grids to cybersecurity, that can support defense. The target does not kick in until 2035, 6 years after Mr. Trump leaves office. I want them to shape up, he said. I think we'll always get along with Europe, but I want them to shape up. I'm the one that got them to spend more on the, you know, more GDP on NATO. But if you look at NATO, Russia, I can tell you, is not at all concerned with any other country but us. The president added, I've been very loyal to Europe. I've done a good job. If it weren't for me, Russia would have all of Ukraine right now. He seemed unconcerned that the last major nuclear arms control agreement with Russia was set to expire in 4 weeks, leaving the world's two largest nuclear powers free to expand their arsenals without limit for the first time in half a century. If it expires, it expires, he said. We'll just do a better agreement, he added, insisting that China, which has the fastest growing arsenal in the world, should be incorporated in any future agreement. You probably want to get a couple of other players involved also, Mr. Trump said. The president seemed equally sanguine about whether his decision to send special operations forces into Caracas to remove Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela would be exploited by China or Russia. In the days since the action in Venezuela, there have been arguments that the U.S. president would help justify a Chinese effort to take Taiwan or Russia's attempt to seize Ukraine, which Mr. Putin has described as a historical part of the Russian Empire dating back more than a dozen centuries. Asked whether he had created a precedent that he may later regret, Mr. Trump argued that his view of the threat posed by Mr. Maduro's Venezuela was quite different than Mr. Xi's view of Taiwan. This is a real threat, he said of Venezuela. You didn't have people pouring into China, he argued, repeating his oft-made claim that Mr. Maduro dumped gang members into the United States. Mr. Trump added, you didn't have drugs pouring into China. You didn't have all the bad things that we've had. You didn't have the jails of Taiwan opened up and the people pouring into China. Or, he said later, criminals and others pouring into Russia. When a reporter noted that Mr. Xi regarded Taiwan as a separatist threat to China, Mr. Trump said, that's up to him what he's going to be doing. But, you know, I've expressed to him that I would be very unhappy if he did that, and I don't think he'll do that. I hope he doesn't. Then, asked whether Mr. Xi might seize on recent events to attack or choke off Taiwan, he suggested that the Chinese leader would not dare to take that step while Mr. Trump was in office. He may do it after we have a different president, but I don't think he's going to do it with me as president, he said. On Thursday, in a rare assertion of congressional authority over the president's war powers, the Senate agreed to debate a resolution aimed at curbing Mr. Trump's use of military force in Venezuela. Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, said one factor that may have tipped the vote was the president's comment during Wednesday's interview that the United States might remain involved in Venezuela for years. On the domestic front, Mr. Trump suggested that judges only have power to restrict his domestic policy agenda, from deployment of the National Guard to the imposition of tariffs, under certain circumstances. But he was already considering workarounds. He raised the possibility that if his tariffs issued under emergency authorities were struck down by the Supreme Court, he could repackage them as licensing fees. And Mr. Trump, who said he was elected to restore law and order, reiterated that he was willing to invoke the Insurrection Act and deploy the military inside the United States and federalize some National Guard units if he felt it was important to do so. So far, he said, I haven't really felt the need to do it. More agents head to Minnesota as U.S. takes over shooting investigation. A day after an ICE agent fatally shot a 37-year-old woman in Minneapolis, the governor activated the state's National Guard, and 100 more federal agents were also being deployed. by Nicholas Bogle Burrows, Mitch Smith, and J.C. Fortin. Disputes between Minnesota officials and the Trump administration intensified Thursday over a federal agent's fatal shooting of a woman after the state withdrew from the investigation into the incident because federal officials had denied it access to evidence. The death of Renee Nicole Good, 37, prompted furious demonstrations. Protesters were met with tear gas at a federal building Thursday morning, and at least 1,000 people gathered in South Minneapolis in the evening. Governor Tim Walz activated the state's National Guard out of an abundance of caution, according to his office, though the troops have not yet been deployed. Documents obtained by the New York Times suggested that at least 100 more federal agents were being deployed to Minnesota. Mayor Jacob Frey of Minneapolis said in an interview on Thursday that the Trump administration would use any chaos as an opportunity to occupy Minneapolis in some form. "Our community members are not taking the bait," he said. Officials have described the killing of Ms. Good in starkly different terms. She was killed on Wednesday during a protest on a residential street as federal agents ordered her to move her vehicle. Administration officials, including President Trump, defended the shooting as lawful, saying that the agent who fired was acting in self-defense. City and state officials described those accounts as propaganda and garbage. A video analysis shows that the woman's vehicle appeared to be turning away from the officer as he opened fire. State officials initially said they would investigate the killing, but Drew Evans, the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, said on Thursday that the agency had withdrawn because it had been denied access to evidence. Mr. Walz said at a news conference on Thursday that Minnesota must be part of this investigation. "I say that only because people in positions of power have already passed judgment," Mr. Walz added. He said that some of the federal government's statements regarding the circumstances of the shooting had been verifiably false. At a news conference in New York City on Thursday, Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, said that Minnesota and Minneapolis officials had failed to maintain order. "They have not been cut out," Ms. Noem told a reporter who had asked about state investigators. "They don't have any jurisdiction in this investigation." Cindy Burnham, a spokeswoman for the FBI office in the Minneapolis area, declined to comment. At a White House press briefing, Vice President J.D. Vance doubled down on claims about the shooting, calling news reporters agents of propaganda of a radical fringe for reports indicating that Ms. Good never put the ICE agent in danger before she was shot. Last year, the federal agent who shot Ms. Good, identified as Jonathan Ross, was dragged about 100 yards by a different driver during an immigration operation in Minnesota, interviews and court records show. He and other agents had been trying to apprehend a Guatemalan man who had been convicted of sexual abuse. Mr. Ross was treated for a gash on his forearm that required 20 stitches after the episode, for which the driver was convicted of assault last month. On social media, Attorney General Pam Bondi warned protesters in Minnesota not to cross a red line into obstructing, impeding, or attacking federal law enforcement. The Department of Homeland Security defended its work in Minnesota on Thursday, pointing to recent arrests of men who they said were in the country illegally and had been convicted of crimes. In the face of violent attacks, ICE law enforcement arrested pedophiles, rapists, and drug traffickers in Minneapolis yesterday, Tricia McLaughlin, a department spokeswoman, said in a statement. Operation Metro Surge, as the department calls it, has resulted in the arrests of more than 1,500 people in Minnesota, she said. Protests against Immigration and Customs Enforcement action in Minneapolis have occurred for weeks, but Ms. Good's killing ratcheted up the tension. Demonstrators gathered Thursday at the Bishop Henry Whipple Federal Building just outside the city, the home of local ICE headquarters. By 9 a.m., federal agents had pushed protesters across the street after deploying tear gas. The building also houses an immigration court, which was closed on Thursday. Public schools were also closed across the city and will remain so on Friday because of safety concerns related to incidents around the city, school officials said in a statement. Demonstrators gathered again on Thursday evening, just blocks from where the shooting happened. At least 1,000 people marched through rainy streets after dark, chanting and waving signs. Yesterday, they shot Renee Nicole Good. And today, news is coming out of Portland that they shot two more people, one organizer told the crowd at the intersection of Lake Street and Chicago Avenue in South Minneapolis. The two people were shot by federal agents on Thursday afternoon in Oregon's largest city, in an incident that also involved people in a vehicle. U.S. Border Patrol agents conducting a targeted vehicle stop opened fire after the driver tried to run over agents, a Homeland Security Department spokeswoman said in a statement. The conditions of the two people were not immediately clear. In Minneapolis, many local and state leaders had been warning for weeks that the surge of immigration enforcement work was bound to stoke chaos. Mr. Waltz put the blame squarely on Mr. Trump and Ms. Noem, asking them to pull back federal agents and declaring at a Wednesday news conference, "You've done enough." Now, more federal agents are on the way. The additional 100 federal agents the Trump administration plans to deploy are Customs and Border Protection officials who will travel to Minnesota from Chicago and New Orleans. The Department of Homeland Security plans to pause operations in Chicago to support the operation in Minnesota. The deployment of additional Border Patrol agents is expected to last through the weekend, with a planned return to their cities on Sunday. The Department of Homeland Security declined to comment on the plans. On Thursday, Mr. Waltz put Minnesota National Guard troops on active duty after placing them on standby the day before. He indicated that while the troops would be staged and ready to help local law enforcement officers, there were no immediate plans to deploy them on the streets. The governor also issued a proclamation declaring Friday as a day of unity in honor of Ms. Good. He encouraged residents to observe a moment of silence and to participate in acts of service. Tensions between federal and Minnesota officials have been exacerbated by a fraud scheme that siphoned money from social service programs in the Minneapolis area. The president has unleashed xenophobic tirades and made repeated derisive comments about members of Minnesota's large Somali diaspora, whose members make up a majority of the fraud defendants. The shooting on Wednesday happened on Portland Avenue, less than a mile away from the spot where George Floyd was killed by police in 2020, prompting angry protests and tearful vigils late into the night. Mr. Fry said on Thursday that there were no major public safety incidents in Minneapolis overnight, and that local officials were still monitoring demonstrations. The city's priorities, he said, were keeping people safe and then getting ICE out of here. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Senate advances measure to curb Trump's use of force in Venezuela. A handful of Republicans joined Democrats to allow the measure to move forward, reflecting concerns in both parties about the administration's strategy. By Robert Jimison and Megan Miniero. The Senate on Thursday agreed to debate a war powers resolution aimed at curbing President Trump's use of military force in Venezuela, with five Republicans joining Democrats in a rare bipartisan rebuke of the White House. The 52-47 vote set the stage for a vote now expected next week on a measure that would force Mr. Trump to seek congressional authorization for continued U.S. military operations in Venezuela. While the resolution has little chance of being enacted or imposing any constraint on Mr. Trump, it was a rare assertion of congressional authority over the president's war powers. It also reflected worries in Mr. Trump's own party about his bellicose and seemingly open-ended action in Venezuela, undertaken with no consultation or authorization by Congress. It came less than a week after he surprised Congress and the nation with a military raid that removed the country's president, Nicolas Maduro, and as Mr. Trump and top administration officials have refused to rule out further military operations there, including American boots on the ground. Democrats, who for months have been pressing unsuccessfully for Republicans to join them in support of a war powers measure, had hoped that the weekend raid inside Venezuela, a dramatic escalation from the strikes in international waters that the military had been carrying out, would persuade them to do so. That ended up being the case. Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Todd Young of Indiana, and Josh Hawley of Missouri, all of whom had opposed similar resolutions in the past, joined all Democrats in backing the measure. So did Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who had previously backed war powers measures. The circumstances have now changed, Ms. Collins said in a statement after voting in support of the measure. While I support the operation to seize Nicolas Maduro, which was extraordinary in its precision and complexity, I do not support committing additional U.S. forces or entering into any long-term military involvement in Venezuela or Greenland without specific congressional authorization. Mr. Trump immediately attacked the Republicans who sided with Democrats on the measure, asserting that they were undermining national security. Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Rand Paul, Josh Hawley, and Todd Young should never be elected to office again, he wrote in a post on his social media site. Ms. Collins is the most vulnerable Senate Republican facing voters this year. Mr. Trump's own assertion in an interview with the New York Times that the United States may be involved in Venezuela for years to come may have been a factor in persuading Republicans to register their alarm by voting for the resolution, said Mr. Paul, the sole Republican sponsor. He said the vote gave a clear signal that only Congress could send the United States to war. He and the Democratic leaders of the resolution, including Senators Tim Kaine of Virginia, Adam B. Schiff of California, and Chuck Schumer of New York, the minority leader, argued that the scale of the operation constituted an act of war requiring congressional approval. Make no mistake, bombing another nation's capital and removing their president is an act of war, plain and simple, Mr. Paul said before the vote. The mission to oust Mr. Maduro and his wife, who were taken to New York for criminal prosecution, was carried out by elite Army Delta Force commandos, and with more than 150 military aircraft, including drones, fighter planes, and bombers, taking part in the mission to disable radar and air defense systems. It was the largest American military action of its kind in years, and resulted in more than 80 deaths, with U.S. service members injured. Key members of Congress were not informed of the mission, a break with decades of tradition and statute that requires congressional notice for covert operations. That has frustrated Democrats and a small group of Republicans who have raised concerns since Mr. Trump began authorizing strikes on boats in the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean in early September. Mr. Kaine rejected the claim by senior Trump administration officials that Saturday's raid was a law enforcement operation and therefore required no consultation or authorization by Congress. This is not an arrest warrant. This is far bigger than that, he said, and it's the kind of hostilities that Congress specifically had in mind when they wrote the War Powers Resolution of 1973. Senior Trump administration officials have given dozens of classified briefings to various groups of lawmakers about the operations, but no public hearings or formal debate over authorization have taken place. An embargo is an act of war, Senator Christopher S. Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, argued before the vote. Repeated military strikes followed on by an invasion is an act of war. He also warned that the actions ran the risk of escalating tensions with global adversaries, namely China and Russia. If the measure were to pass the Senate, a vote would be required in the House, which rejected two similar War Powers resolutions last month. But even if the measure were to pass both chambers, Mr. Trump would be all but certain to veto it. And with a vast majority of Republicans strongly supporting Mr. Trump on Venezuela, overriding a presidential veto, which requires two-thirds votes in both chambers, is highly unlikely. Many Republicans argued on Thursday that Congress has no role in the matter. Can you use military force as commander-in-chief without a declaration of war? Asked Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina. The answer is yes. He and other Republicans have likened the intervention in Venezuela to operations directed by former presidents that were never authorized by Congress, including one by George H.W. Bush in Panama to capture Manuel Noriega, the dictator whose ties to drug trafficking led to his ouster in 1989. I don't want to hear anybody tell me that this has never been done before, Mr. Graham said. It's actually the norm. What's odd in America is to declare war by the Congress. Senator Jim Risch of Idaho, the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, who has been an outspoken supporter of Mr. Trump's actions to curb the influx of narcotics into the United States, said before the vote that lawmakers backing the measure were merely trying to slap the president in the face. This vote and similar votes before it are an abuse of the War Powers Act, Mr. Risch said moments before the roll call. The United States conducted a limited operation to remove an indicted narco-terrorist. Still, the vote reflected a notable shift after months in which many Republicans had privately expressed concern about the administration's lack of consultation with lawmakers, but declined to even allow a debate on imposing limits on Mr. Trump. President Trump campaigned against forever wars, and I strongly support him in that position, Mr. Young said in a statement. A drawn-out campaign in Venezuela involving the American military, even if unintended, would be the opposite of President Trump's goal of ending foreign entanglements. House passes spending package before another shutdown deadline. The legislation would fund parts of the government ahead of a January 30th deadline in a bipartisan breakthrough after the nation's longest shutdown. By Katie Edmondson. The House on Thursday overwhelmingly passed legislation to reject steep cuts requested by President Trump and fund parts of the government, including the Justice and Commerce Departments, in a bipartisan breakthrough before a January 30th spending deadline. Action on the roughly $180 billion package signaled progress toward a broader agreement that could avoid the kind of bitter spending fight last fall that prompted the longest government shutdown in the nation's history. The vote was 397-28, with 22 Republicans and 6 Democrats opposed. The package still must pass the Senate before it can be sent to Mr. Trump, but it appeared to be on track for enactment. White House officials said in a statement of administration policy on Wednesday that he would sign the legislation. At the same time, lawmakers are racing to finalize 6 additional spending bills to ensure the government does not shut down at the end of January. Those remaining measures, which include funding the Homeland Security and Health and Human Services departments, are considered some of the most difficult to reach bipartisan consensus on. In the legislative package that lawmakers unveiled this week, appropriators rejected the steep cuts that Mr. Trump's budget had put forward earlier this year, and instead proposed slight trims or spending freezes to the budgets of several agencies, and slight increases in others. Rather than acquiescing to Mr. Trump's request to cut funding for the National Science Foundation by 57%, for example, lawmakers held its budget flat. The Appropriations Committee has long sought to operate in a bipartisan and collaborative manner, and with today's package, we fulfill that longstanding commitment, said Representative Tom Cole, Republican of Oklahoma and the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. The end result is a reminder for us all that consensus, not partisan obstruction, is not only possible, it is preferable. Conservatives who would have preferred steeper spending cuts said they were appeased by the fact that the bills represented a return to regular order, the practice of writing and passing individual spending bills, rather than lumping all 12 funding bills together into a behemoth package or enacting a stopgap emergency funding measure to keep funding flat. The legislative package contains a slew of earmarks requested by both Democrats and Republicans for projects in their communities. That drew objections from some conservative House Republicans who have long opposed the practice of lawmakers inserting funding for individual projects into spending bills, deeming it an inappropriate use of federal funds. Earmarks are the currency of corruption, and they're coming back in full force in these products, Representative Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, said. He successfully killed an earmark requested by Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, that would have provided $1 million in funding to a Somali-led nonprofit organization that described itself as dedicated to creating a better, safer, and more connected community for individuals experiencing drug addiction in the East African community in the Twin Cities. Democrats said the compromise bills, which did not include any partisan policy dictates offered by Republicans, would create stricter spending guardrails for the Trump administration to follow than if they had adopted a stopgap funding bill. I understand there may be some of my Democratic colleagues who are apprehensive about providing any funding for this administration, an administration that has abused its authority time and time again while thumbing its nose at Congress and the rule of law, said Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, the top Democrat on the Appropriations Committee. But abandoning the regular order appropriations process does nothing to rein in this administration. All it does is forfeit our ability to fight for the priorities that are important to us, to our constituents, and to the American people. The bill also includes language written by senators that would require a number of agencies that were decimated by the Department of Government efficiency, such as the National Park Service and the National Weather Service, to maintain staffing levels in order to fulfill the mission of the agencies. Some Democrats had pressed Republicans to include narrower language, but Republicans argued that mandating a certain head count of employees was overly prescriptive. The reason that we had tougher language was because we don't want to give this discretion to the Office of Management and Budget, which clearly has made the judgment that the National Weather Service has too many human beings working at the National Weather Service, Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, and an appropriator, said at a hearing considering his chamber's version of the legislation last year. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Judge bars U.S. attorney in Albany from inquiry into Letitia James. Ms. James, New York's attorney general, had been seeking to block a Justice Department investigation into her office by challenging the legitimacy of the U.S. attorney, John A. Sarcone III, by Jonah Bromwich. A judge on Thursday barred the top federal prosecutor in Albany, New York, from any further involvement with a civil rights investigation into the state's attorney general, Letitia James, in another setback for the Trump administration as it pursues Ms. James. The prosecutor, John A. Sarcone III, can no longer lead the investigation after lawyers for Ms. James challenged the legitimacy of his appointment as they sought to quash subpoenas related to the matter, one of several inquiries that the Justice Department has mounted against the Attorney General. Mr. Sarcone, the acting U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of New York, remains in charge of the office, though the decision by the judge, Lorna G. Schofield, opens the possibility that Mr. Sarcone could be completely removed from the post. The civil rights investigation into Ms. James began in August, when Mr. Sarcone sent her office a pair of subpoenas. One was related to a civil fraud case that Ms. James had brought against President Trump, in which she sued him, accusing him of exaggerating his net worth to defraud lenders. The other subpoena was related to her office's long-running case against the National Rifle Association. Judge Schofield said in an order on Thursday that Mr. Sarcone was not lawfully serving as acting U.S. attorney when the subpoenas were issued. The judge blocked the subpoenas, but said that the federal government could seek to reissue them at the direction of a lawfully authorized attorney. Mr. Sarcone referred a reporter to the Justice Department's press office in Washington when asked for comment. "This Department of Justice will continue to fight and defend the president and the attorney general's authority to appoint their U.S. attorneys," said a department spokesman, Chad Gilmartin. He did not directly answer a question about whether the department was planning to appeal Judge Schofield's ruling. "This decision is an important win for the rule of law, and we will continue to defend our office's successful litigation from this administration's political attacks," a spokesman for Ms. James said. The disqualification of Mr. Sarcone from the case is the second time in 3 months that a judge has found a U.S. attorney to have been illegitimately installed by the Trump administration, bypassing a Senate confirmation. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said that Judge Schofield had confirmed what was obvious from the start. "The Trump administration tried to cut corners, ignore the law, and bypass the Senate, and the court shut it down," Mr. Schumer said. The attorney general was indicted in the Eastern District of Virginia in October over bank fraud. She called the charges baseless and vowed to fight them. But the charges were thrown out when a judge found that the U.S. attorney in that district, Lindsay Halligan, had been appointed invalidly. Since then, two grand juries have rejected proposed charges against Ms. James. Though Ms. James did not explicitly pursue Mr. Sarcone's removal from office, Judge Schofield's ruling appears to open the door to him being disqualified in the same manner as Ms. Halligan and a number of other U.S. attorneys installed by the Trump administration. "Mr. Sarcone is not lawfully serving as acting U.S. attorney," the judge wrote. "Any of his past or future acts taken in that capacity are void or voidable, as they would rest on authority Mr. Sarcone does not lawfully have." That conclusion could encourage defense lawyers in Mr. Sarcone's district to challenge his legitimacy in seeking the dismissal of cases against their clients. Successful challenges of that type have been brought in New Jersey, Nevada, California, and Virginia. Judges in the Northern District declined to appoint Mr. Sarkoni as permanent U.S. attorney after his interim status expired in July. He was then appointed as a special attorney, which the Justice Department claimed gave him the powers of a U.S. attorney indefinitely. But arguments defending such maneuvers have fallen flat, as Judge Schofield noted in her Thursday order. Since August 2025, she wrote, federal courts have uniformly held that these appointments are invalid. Mr. Sarkoni has an unorthodox background for a U.S. attorney and has had a similarly unusual tenure. He has no previous prosecutorial experience and spent the early part of his appointment getting into scraps with reporters and the police. The subpoenas to Ms. James' office, which asked for an unusually broad amount of material, also requested that the response be delivered to Mr. Sarkoni personally. Partially quoting another judge's opinion, Judge Schofield said that the grand juries were not meant to be the private tool of a prosecutor, much less one who is not lawfully appointed. Russian strikes knock out power and heat to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. The Ukrainian authorities urged residents in the Dnipropetrovsk region to stock up on water as crews raced to restore service. By Cassandra Vinograd. About 500,000 households were still without heat and power in the Dnipropetrovsk region of Ukraine on Thursday evening as authorities raced in the winter cold to restore services knocked out by Russian strikes the previous night. The Ukrainian authorities said that crews were working furiously to restore service, and they urged people to stock up on water and conserve batteries. The local authorities and power companies said that about 500,000 customers were still without service as of Thursday late afternoon, down from about 1 million in the morning, and that it was unclear when services would be fully restored. Restoration work has been going on nonstop since last night. Crews from all over the region are working, DTEK, one of Ukraine's main power companies, said in a statement. As soon as we restore all critical infrastructure, we will do everything possible to restore power to families as quickly as possible. New air raid warnings and the threat of further attacks were delaying the work, DTEK later said. Russian forces have been pounding Ukraine's power grid in recent months. Moscow has deployed the tactic to devastating effect for the past three winters of the war, in what President Volodymyr Zelensky has called a campaign to break the will of Ukrainians. This winter, Russia has also been striking Ukraine's gas infrastructure, wells, storage sites, pipelines, and other critical components, to take out heat as well. The mayor of Dnipro City, the regional capital, declared a state of emergency on Thursday, and Mr. Zelensky urged allies to respond to this deliberate torment of our people by Russia. There is absolutely no military rationale in such strikes on the energy sector and infrastructure that leave people without electricity and heating in wintertime, he said in a statement. Mr. Zelensky has repeatedly accused Russia of stalling the U.S.-led negotiations to end the war, and on Thursday, he called for more pressure to be brought to bear on Moscow. Right now, Russia is betting more on winter than on diplomacy, on ballistic missiles against our energy system rather than on working with the United States and agreements with President Trump, he added later in his nightly address. This must change through pressure on Russia and continued support for Ukraine. It was not immediately clear what sites were hit in the attack on Dnipropetrovsk region, which began on Wednesday night while temperatures hovered below freezing. The Regional Military Administration said that air defenses had downed 31 Russian drones in the region, but that infrastructure in three districts had sustained damage. Strikes also knocked out power to much of the Zaporizhia region, but it was largely restored as of Thursday morning, according to Ukraine's grid operator, Ukrenergo. Like much of Europe, cold weather has gripped Ukraine in recent days. The authorities have warned that temperatures are expected to plummet to minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit at night, or about minus 20 degrees Celsius, and 14 degrees Fahrenheit during the day. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Iran is cut off from internet as protests calling for regime change intensify. As protests swelled around the country, Iran's internet was shut down, and the heads of its judiciary and its security services warned of a harsh response amid calls for freedom, freedom. By Farnaz Fasihi, Pranav Bhaskar, and Sanam Mahusi. Iran plunged into an internet blackout on Thursday, monitoring groups said, as nationwide protests demanding the ouster of the Islamic government spread to multiple cities and grew in size, according to witnesses. The internet shutdown came a day after the heads of Iran's judiciary and its security services said they would take tough measures against anyone protesting, but the threats did not deter demonstrators. In telephone interviews, more than a dozen witnesses said that they saw large crowds forming on Thursday night in neighborhoods across Tehran, the capital, and in cities around Iran, including Mashhad, Bushehr, Shiraz, and Isfahan. They said the crowds were diverse, with men and women, young and old. The people interviewed inside Iran asked that their names not be published out of fear of retribution. One resident of Tehran said that crowds were chanting "Death to Khamenei," referring to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and "Freedom, freedom." The chants could be heard from several blocks away in the affluent neighborhood of Sharak Garb in Tehran, which had, until now, sat out the protests. Videos filmed on Thursday night showed government buildings on fire across the country, including Tehran, as protests grew. While protests were mostly peaceful early in the evening, violence broke out later in the night in Tehran, with demonstrators setting fire to cars, buildings, and items in the street. A video verified by the New York Times shows fires in the streets of Kaj Square in the capital, with thousands of protesters flooding the area. In Karaj, a suburb of West Tehran, a video verified by the Times showed protesters fleeing after gunshots were fired, though it is unclear from the videos whether it was security forces firing. As the protests grew, internet connectivity data showed an abrupt and near total drop in connection levels in Iran on Thursday afternoon, according to NetBlocks, an internet monitoring group, and the Georgia Institute of Technology's Internet Outage Detection and Analysis database. The data indicates that the country is almost completely offline. Iran officials did not immediately respond to questions about the cause of the shutdown, but the government has previously enforced internet blackouts during moments of crisis. During the country's 12-day war with Israel last June, Iran blocked access to the internet, saying that it was a necessary security measure to stop Israeli infiltration. That measure also cut off the flow of information outward to the rest of the world. The Iranian government uses internet shutdowns as a tool of repression, said Omed Mamarian, an Iranian human rights expert and senior fellow at Dawn, a Washington-based organization focused on the Middle East. Whenever protests reach a critical point, authorities sever the country's connection to the global internet to isolate protesters and limit their communication with the outside world. Iranians have been protesting against the authoritarian rule of the Islamic clerics for decades, in wave after wave of protests that have been repeatedly crushed. The latest round of protests began a week ago. Multiple opposition groups, including Kurdish political groups, the Coordination Council of Azerbaijani Parties, and Reza Pahlavi, the son of the deposed Shah of Iran, had all called for people inside Iran to take to the streets. Mr. Pahlavi had said in a video message that people opposing the government should come to the streets at 8 p.m. on Thursday. Pro-democracy activists, such as Nobel Prize laureate Narges Mohammadi, who is currently in detention, said in a statement with 17 prominent dissidents and film directors last week that the demand for democracy could not be quashed. A resident in the southern city of Bushehr said the crowd was so large that the security forces retreated. A resident of Isfahan said that a crowd of protesters marched, drivers honked and waved, and people in nearby apartment buildings whistled in solidarity. A resident of Sadeqiya, a middle-class neighborhood in Tehran, said the crowd was swelling in size by the hour. He said security forces had fired their weapons into the air and fired tear gas canisters, but did not disperse the crowd. He said that some people in the crowd chanted, "Long live the Shah," a reference to the last monarch in Iran who was toppled in the 1979 revolution. Ibrahim Azizi, the head of the Parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Committee, said in a post on social media that the Zionist regime, referring to Israel, was behind the protests. "The destabilization puzzle has been activated, a puzzle that the Iranian nation will not allow to be completed," he added. A senior government official who did not want to be identified said in an interview that many officials were privately calling and texting one another at a loss of how to contain the avalanche of protests. He said the Revolutionary Guard Corps, typically in charge of securing Iran's borders, not internal security, would likely take over. The slogans chanted by the crowd covered an array of political views, but with one united target: the end of the Islamic regime. Amir Ali, a 32-year-old businessman in Tehran, said he and a group of friends had joined the protests and chanted, "Death to the oppressor, be it king or supreme leader, and the street will prevail, the people will win." Shima, a 52-year-old from Tehran, said she and her husband, her teenage children, and her elderly parents were all on the streets Thursday night protesting for the first time as a family and chanting, "We are together, we are together, don't be afraid," and "Clerics, get lost, the Shah is coming back." As the protest movement has spread to cities across the country, the head of Iran's judiciary, Gholam Hossein Mohseni Ejji, told Iranian media that the protests were plotted by the country's enemy and the government would show no mercy. "This time it's different. This time there are no excuses left," he said. "The enemy has officially announced its support. I tell the people and the families that this time no one will be spared." Amnesty International said in a statement on Thursday that it had documented at least 28 protesters killed in the recent days of protest, including children. Three other groups that document and track human rights, HRANA, based in Washington, Iran Human Rights, based in Norway, and the Hengaw Organization for Human Rights, put the toll higher at more than 40. Amir Parsa Neshat, an Iranian influencer and podcaster who supports the protests, was arrested when security forces raided his home in the middle of the night. Kaveh Rad, a lawyer, and one of his relatives announced on his Instagram on Thursday morning. On Wednesday, a crowd of several hundred men stormed into a Shia seminary that trains clerics in the city of Ghanabad, ransacking the building and beating up the clerics with wood and batons, said a statement from the cleric who directs the seminary, which was published in Iranian media. "We too are protesting the high prices, but protests are different than riots. People must part ways with rioters," said the statement from the cleric, Hushan al-Islam Ismaili Tavakoli. Merchants and business owners in the traditional bazaars in the cities of Tehran, Tabriz, Isfahan, Mashhad, and Kerman have closed their shops to protest the dire state of the economy and the plunging value of Iran's currency, according to interviews with witnesses and Iranian news media reports. These bazaars are at the heart of the country's commerce and economy, and strikes could paralyze the economy if they continued. And finally, we have two obituaries today. Steve Sheets, who popularized convenience stores as a CEO, dies at 77. Sheets, a family-owned company that started with a single convenience store in Altoona, Pennsylvania, has more than 800 locations in seven states. By Neil Vigdor. Stephen G. Sheets, who helped transform a family business from a single convenience store in Altoona, Pennsylvania, into a ubiquitous chain with fierce brand loyalties, popular for its coffee, made-to-order food, and cheap gasoline, died on Sunday in Altoona. He was 77. His death was confirmed by the Sheets Company, which said the cause was respiratory complications after he was hospitalized with pneumonia. Mr. Sheets led the convenience store chain as chief executive and president from 1984 to 1995, presiding over the company's expansion. From 1995 to 2013, he was the board chairman. What began in 1952 as Sheets Quick Shopper, a modest convenience store opened by his brother Bob Sheets in their hometown, spawned multiple outlets over the decades as the business became a major chain. Its success resembled that of another Pennsylvania institution that occupies a similar retail niche and has competed with Sheets for customers' loyalties, Wawa. Sheetz expanded from 14 locations in 1972 to 100 in 1983, offering customers the ability to pump their own gas. Known for its touchscreen kiosks for ordering and its emphasis on clean restrooms, the chain now has more than 800 convenience stores in 7 states, including Michigan, where it opened its first outlet in 2024. As of 2025, Sheetz had electric vehicle charging stations in at least 100 sites. Steve's guidance shaped nearly every aspect of our family business, Joe Sheetz, one of Mr. Sheetz's nephews and the company's current chairman, said in a statement. Born on January 7, 1948 in Altoona, which is about 100 miles east of Pittsburgh, Mr. Sheetz was the third youngest of 8 siblings. He began working part-time at his brother's convenience store when he was 12 years old. He graduated from Penn State in 1969 with a degree in business management. In 2010, Penn State named Mr. Sheetz and his wife Nancy as its Philanthropists of the Year, 1 year after the couple pledged $2.5 million to Penn State Altoona, the largest donation at the time in that branch's 70-year history. The couple increased their commitment to $3 million in 2010, funding the creation of an entrepreneurial center and a Sheetz Fellows program. In addition to his wife, he is survived by 2 daughters, 7 grandchildren, and 6 of his 7 siblings, including his brother Bob. Linda Blackman Lowry, one of the youngest Selma marchers, dies at 75. Her activism began as a teenager in 1963 when she heard the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak. It set her on a path to nonviolent protest. By Richard Sandomir. Linda Blackman Lowry, a young foot soldier in the fight for voting rights in Selma, Alabama, who was 14 when law enforcement officers savagely attacked her and many other unarmed protesters on Bloody Sunday in 1965, died on December 24th at her home in Selma. She was 75. Her daughter, Danita Blackman, confirmed the death but did not specify a cause. Ms. Lowry, then known as Linda Blackman, said she was arrested 9 times before she turned 15 for participating in civil rights protests. In one of the pivotal events of the civil rights movement, she gathered with some 600 people on March 7, 1965, on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma for a planned march to Alabama's capital, Montgomery. From the crest of the bridge, they could see white state troopers and sheriff's deputies, some on horseback, wielding nightsticks and whips, ready to enforce the segregationist Governor George C. Wallace's order to halt the march. At first, I tried to tell myself it would be okay, because there were so many of us, Ms. Lowry recalled in her 2015 book, Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March, which she wrote with Elsbeth Leacock and Susan Buckley. Then I saw the state troopers putting on gas masks, and I got really scared. I'd only seen a gas mask on TV, but somehow I knew something dangerous was happening. After ignoring orders to disperse, the marchers felt tear gas burning their eyes and lungs. She heard a crude racial epithet shouted at her and remembered being grabbed by a man who struck her twice with a baseball bat, leaving gashes that required 7 stitches over her right eye and 28 on the back of her head. He continued to hit her as she fled. Many others were violently attacked as well, including the civil rights leader John Lewis, one of the march's organizers, whose skull was fractured by a trooper's billy club. Bloodied, she was placed on a stretcher, but she jumped off and began running. That's when she saw her sister Joanne lying in a man's arms, she recalled. I ran to him crying, "Oh, she's dead, they killed my sister." Told that her sister was alive, but that she had fainted, she slapped her on the side of the face, Ms. Lowry wrote. Once her sister came to, they ran to a church for safety. They were soon driven to a hospital, and Joanne, who was lying on her sister's lap in the car, remembered the blood from Ms. Lowry's wounds dripping on her face. I was 14 years old, Ms. Lowry said in American Dignity, 2025, a short documentary film directed by Hanson Hossein in collaboration with Common Power, a voting rights organization. I had done nothing. Nobody on that bridge that day had done anything for that blatant brutality. Linda Diane Blackman was born on March 22, 1950, in Selma. Her father, Alfred Blackman, was a cab driver. Her mother, Ludie Wright Blackman, died in childbirth at a hospital in 1957 at age 34 while waiting for blood to arrive from Birmingham. I heard my grandmother and the older people saying that she wouldn't have died if she hadn't been colored, Miss Lowry said in an oral interview in 2021 with the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza in Dallas, which chronicles the history of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and considers civil rights part of his legacy. In 1963, her maternal grandmother, who had helped care for her after her mother's death, took Linda to the Tabernacle Baptist Church in Selma to hear the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak. In that speech, he said three words that I have lived by since the age of 13, Miss Lowry said in her oral history. He said, "You can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation." At first, the words didn't sink in, but when he repeated them, she said that she jumped up and exclaimed, "That's how I'm going to do it." She joined the civil rights movement first as a gopher, her tasks including informing parents when their children had been arrested, and later as a protester, which led to her arrests and incarceration. When a federal judge authorized another march from Selma to Montgomery, this one to start on March 21st, she said she wanted to go. She asked her father for permission, but he agreed only when two older activists, Amelia Boynton Robinson and Marie Foster, promised to look after her, Ms. Lowry's sister Joanne Bland said in an interview. Although thousands rallied in Selma and Montgomery, only 300 marched all the way from one city to the other, potentially dangerous territory that included a long stretch of a two-lane highway. Linda was chosen to be one of those who completed the full 54-mile trek because she was among the most dedicated to the movement, Charles Maudlin, who was a 17-year-old student marshal during the march, said in an interview. She was also one of the youngest in the group, Ms. Bland said. On the second day of the march, Linda turned 15. That morning, she panicked at the sight of three National Guard members with bayonets on their rifles, believing that they were going to kill her. After being assured that they were there for protection, she calmed down. On the final day, when the marchers reached Montgomery, she looked around for Governor Wallace outside the Capitol building. "They said he was behind the curtain peeking out, but I couldn't tell," she recalled in her book. "I got as close as I could and shouted, 'I'm here, Governor Wallace, I'm here.'" After returning to school, she continued to attend protest meetings but no longer marched or was arrested. The inhumanity that had been inflicted on Ms. Lowry and the other Selma marchers was captured on national television, catalyzing congressional support for the Voting Rights Act, which banned racial discrimination in balloting. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the act into law on August 6, 1965. "We had won," Ms. Lowry wrote. "My buddies and I, who had gone to jail so many times, had won." Ms. Lowry went on to work as a home health aide and safety officer before receiving a bachelor's degree in sociology from the College of Staten Island in New York in 1982. For many years, she was a case manager at a mental health center in Selma. In addition to her daughter, Danita, and Ms. Bland, Ms. Lowry is survived by another daughter, Benita Blackman, three grandchildren, and a grandson. Her husband, Collie Lowry, died in 2019. Ms. Bland is a founder of Foot Soldiers Park, an organization dedicated to preserving Selma's civil rights history and supporting the city's Black community. The Foot Soldiers who marched in Selma on Bloody Sunday received the Congressional Gold Medal in 2016. Like many of them, Ms. Lowry was troubled by the violence they had endured and its long aftermath. Years later, crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge could still make her tremble. About 5 years ago, she was traumatized when she looked at photographs of herself being beaten during the protest, images she had never seen before, Ms. Buckley, her co-author, said. "I still deal with, occasionally, those memories," Ms. Lowry said in American Dignity, "but they're back far enough for me to be able to share it with somebody else, so they'll know how I feel." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, January 9th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.